Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening to all who are listening to the Wise Women Media Radio Show, and for those of you that also listen later in the archives, we want to thank you for joining us. We have a special guest tonight, but first let me go over our sponsors. Roundtree 7, Here Be Monsters, Daughters of Isis, The Hoodoo Blog, Power New Media and Public Relations, Tarot and Stars, and Florida Nature Photos. Also, there is a WePay link on our website at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com. Please give whatever you can so you can help us keep the show on the air. Tonight, our special guest will be Dr. Wilma Subra. She's going to talk with us about a little bit about what's been happening over at the Bayou Corn in Louisiana. It looks like there's some threatening things happening over there, and some of those things are definitely linked to what has already happened in the Gulf of Mexico. and more about the petrochemical industry. And I also wanted to let you all know who did that amazing cover of System of a Down's song Toxicity. And I haven't been able to find a name for her, but her name is VK Goes Wild on YouTube. So if you look up System of a Down Toxicity piano cover, you will find her, and she's pretty amazing on the keyboard. She actually took the song and made it into a classical song pretty amazingly. I'm looking to see if she has joined us yet. No, she has not, but let me go over a little bit about who Dr. Wilma Suber is. She is the president of the Suber Company. She's a scientist, a past vice chair of the Environmental Protection Agency, National Advisory Council for Environmental Policy and Technology, or NACEPT, N-A-C-E-P-T. Her company provides technical assistance to citizens concerned with environmental issues by combining technical research and evaluation. And Dr. Wilma Suber has been tirelessly working in the Gulf of Mexico region. I'm going to click her. She's actually here. I'm going to click her on here. Hi, Dr. Wilma Suber. Is that you with us?
Yes, it is. Good evening.
Hey, thank you for joining us. I gave you an introduction. There was a great song called Toxicity by System of a Down, and it was actually a cover that was turned from kind of anarchist rock into classical pretty amazingly. But we wanted to talk a little bit about what's been happening in the Bayou Corn and probably some other issues, too, up there in Louisiana. A good friend of mine had interviewed you for her article, which is now headlining over at Op-Ed News. The name of the article is, Does Sudden Sinkhole Portend a Nuclear-Sized Explosion? The author's name is Merrill Ann Butler, and she's one of the senior editors over at Op-Ed News. She's been with them for quite some time, a number of years. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in this work, and then we can go on to what is actually happening in Bayou Corn?
Sure. Well, I provide technical assistance to community groups dealing with environmental issues, and I formed my own company specifically to do that in 1981. So I am more than 30 years old providing technical assistance to community groups, helping to educate them, helping them to understand what's going on, and giving them the information they need to then make decisions for their communities.
And what I know, there's been a lot of really crazy updates going on just over the past 48 hours at Bayou Corn. Can you kind of start from the beginning on how you found out about this and what you've been able to do and figure out since this has become a major issue? Really, what was happening really started several months ago. Can you kind of give us a timeline on that?
Sure. So 2.5 months ago, there was bubbling of natural gas in Bayou Corn and the other bayou areas around there. And this is a very wetland area. And it was in the same area over the Napoleonville Salt Dome where in 2003 a Dow well had sprung a leak that was a storage cavern well, and it had released all of the material in the cavern into the environment, and the people that lived in the houses over them were sort of like tents. The houses would catch the gas, and it was explosive and toxic, so all of those people had to be relocated. And a lot of them were relocated to the Bayou Corn area, and Bayou Corn had started bubbling 2.5 months ago. So I've been down there dealing with the community, dealing with the situation, and in August the 3rd, a sinkhole developed over the cavern that Texas Brine had previously used as a solution mining cavern to provide salt water to the industries on the Mississippi River, the area known as Cancer Alley, and they used this brine to produce chlorine, which is a building block of all the petrochemical plants. So So the issue became, well, the sinkhole developed right over the cavern, so it was obviously the cavern, even though the agencies previously, over the 2 months, had looked at whether pipelines were leaking, whether old plugged or unplugged and abandoned wells were leaking, and just drug their feet about looking at the cavern that was closest to the area. And when it started developing the sinkhole and the sinkhole started growing, then it was clear that it was associated with that cavern. And then the last 2 days, yesterday, they lost 50 additional feet of ground into the sinkhole on the northwest side. And then by this morning, they had lost another 20 feet on the east side. So it's continuing to slough off. And the sinkhole is now more than 400 feet deep.
Oh, my God. What happened with the – now, I was getting the news, and I was posting it on my Hoodoo blog, some of the videos that were coming out through the local news reports there, and they seemed to really be downplaying the issue. But the one that kind of frightened me was getting the information about the two workers that almost that were almost lost in the sinkhole. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, on August the 3rd, when the sinkhole developed, the next day, August the 4th, some of the pipelines actually started disintegrating in the area of the subsidence, and they evacuated 150 homes, which consists of about 350 people, out of the area while they removed the chemicals and the natural gas from these pipelines. And as part of this sinkhole, there is a huge diesel blanket on top of the sinkhole, which originated from the storage cavern. As they leached out the brine, they kept a diesel blanket on the top to stop the roof from dissolving. And this diesel blanket is now floating in the sinkhole. So these workers were out skimming the diesel blanket because it was causing a lot of really intense air emissions. And yesterday, while they were actually skimming operations, and they had their Joe boat actually tied to a tree, additional land started subsiding into the sinkhole. The two workers had to be rescued by an airboat. They managed to get their equipment and themselves on the airboat, and then when the tree went down, it pulled their boat down into the sinkhole, but they were rescued.
Oh, my God. So it's at this point, it's not even safe. So how are they going to actually know what's going on if they're not having workers and people monitoring the emission level and everything else? How is this going to be done now?
Well, they are continuing to monitor the emissions levels, and they are actually starting work tonight driving the surface casing on a well which is called a reentry well, so that they can go back into that cavern and see exactly where the cavern failed in 2010 and 2011 when it failed the mechanical integrity test. But they're able to keep people in the area. They would like the residents to be out of the area, so if there is an emergency, they don't have to deal with the residents. They can deal with the situation.
Now, you had mentioned that most of the residents in Bayou Corn had been relocated from the first area a number of years ago. How far are those two areas from each other? Where
just
they
a
were
couple of
originally
miles.
And the relocation in Bayou Corn.
Right. Where they lived before was over the Napoleonville Dome, and they just moved to the other side of the Napoleonville Dome. The dome itself is actually 3 miles by a mile. So they basically just moved to the other side of the dome in the same area because that's where all their relatives were, and they've been there for generations.
So it's not – the whole area is definitely not safe at this point.
At this point, it is still – the situation is still degrading day by day.
And the recovery well, I had been glancing and actually scanning over Meryl Ann's article, and she had mentioned that it takes 40 days to actually do the process with the new well. The recovery well. 40 days? Are these people safe that are even close by at that point for 40 days?
Well, that was the issue when they announced that they had found a rig that was available to be moved to the site to start the new well. then they did an estimate of how long it would take to actually drill down and get into the cavern, and the estimate was 40 days. And that was real depressing to the people in the area because they had hoped to have some resolution a lot sooner than that. But they realized that the issue is until they find out what's in that cavern and what went wrong with that cavern, you can't then start making the situation right. But you have to understand that it's an estimate of 40 days to get to the cavern, and once they get to the cavern, then they have to start sending all the monitoring equipment in the cavern, so it's going to be much more than 40 days.
Oh, it's kind of misleading in regards to, you know, the time frame. Now, also, I see that Merrill Ann actually added something to this article. For anybody that wants to read this article, there's also pictures and graphs on it. The article is a headlining article on opednews.com, and the title of it is, Does Sudden Sinkhole Portend a Nuclear-Sized Explosion? So you will see that on the headline status of Op-Ed News. Just click into it, and there's all kinds of info, pictures, graphs. And she had put an update on, it was the latest, at 10:40 EDT on August 17th, I got another email from Wilma Subra. An additional 20 feet on the east side of the sinkhole were noted sloughed off this morning. So this is an ongoing situation. It's not like this sinkhole is just, it's growing. It's actually getting bigger, and it can definitely threaten local area, the environment, everything else. Nobody knows what's going to happen. What did you think about her headline on that story? Can it blow?
Well, the issue is that in the Napoleonville Dome, there are more than 50 caverns. Some of them are used to dissolve the brine and for the industry. Others are used to store different materials. And right near the Texas Brine Cavern that is the focus of all of this is a cavern that is storing butane. And so the issue is everyone was very concerned that the disruption in the integrity of more than one cavern could occur as this keeps escalating. The Department of Environmental Quality actually asked the company that operates the butane cavern, CrossTex, to do a worst-case scenario, and that information came out last night, and it clearly showed that unless you pump brine down, you can't force the butane back to the surface. But the issue is if that cavern loses integrity, then it's a whole different story. So it's a degrading situation on a day-to-day basis. They also experienced lots of earthquakes while the gas was bubbling up in the bayous. And then right as the sinkhole developed, the earthquake sort of dissipated. But I've been looking at all the earthquake monitors, and we were able to see what was occurring from the monitors. But then as they started preparing the pad and moving the equipment on for the well, it just was making such a lot of disruption in the earth that it's overlapping the monitors for the earthquake. So if an earthquake occurs, you're not going to see it because there's so much surface activity going on with the well.
So you would, even if people are looking at USGS and looking at the activity there, it's probably not going to be accurate. It's kind of, because most of us that are not scientists, we tend to go to USGS when we want to, you know, find out about earthquake activity. That seems to be like the catch-all site for that information. So what you're saying is it's probably not going to be accurate because of the
There are a number of monitors that they put in to the Bayou Corn area specifically for this. So on a day-by-day basis, a different monitor starts having increased activity that it's not possible. Now, once they start drilling, they're going to be drilling round the clock. Up until this point when they were constructing the pad, they were doing it in mostly daylight hours, and you could still see at night whether or not any earthquake activity was occurring. But once it starts round the clock, it's just going to obliterate all of that information.
Well, I wanted to say to everybody that's in the chat room, thank you for listening. And I also wanted to say if you have your questions, you can post them in the chat room, but feel free to actually call and ask Dr. Subra the questions right on the air if you prefer. The number is 213-816-0357. Again, 213-816-0357. We have quite a lot of people in the chat room. We see Laura Reagan. Actually, she's typing, so I know she's got a question. So I also, what was interesting on this article that Marilyn wrote, she said, alligators reside in the bayou and are reportedly still there. Hopefully someone is paying close attention to their behavior and will take notice if they all suddenly leave. And what is your take on that? Is anybody out there actually monitoring the wildlife? Because the wildlife are going to feel or know when something is amiss under the ground. What would be some of the things or the patterns that wildlife would probably do if they do sense something is amiss down there?
Well, first of all, the wildlife and fishery agent for the state of Louisiana is there on the site and watching all of these things. The people that live in Bayou Corn live on the bayous and know how the animals behave. So even though they're evacuated, they come back and frequently check on their houses, and not all of them decided to evacuate. So they are all watching. They've been watching for fish kills. They've been watching for different activities that they know are not normal, and that's being watched on a day-to-day basis.
Wow, that is and let me read Laura Reagan's question. She's asking, how much area could blow? Like, how big is the area that we need to worry about? I'm outside of New Orleans. Are we safe?
Oh, yes. It's a much more confined area than that. The estimate in the vulnerable zone right now is about 1,400 feet. As the sinkhole keeps growing, they'll expand that. But the thought is that the area on top of the cavern is the most vulnerable right now. And unless it impacts an adjacent cavern and messes up its integrity, it should be limited to somewhere around 1,400 feet. But again, it's still developing day by day. So at this point, that's what we're looking at. But it could grow much larger, depending on what it does to the other 50-plus caverns in the dome.
I wanted to ask a question about what is happening with LEAN and what kind of an active role has that organization taken in this particular situation?
Well, I provide technical assistance to LEAN, so I've been developing all this data and reviewing all of the data and all of the analysis that are coming out. LEAN's actually been out in the field as well. I've been out in the field on a constant basis. And then LEAN's doing these e-alerts, and I'm sure you've seen some of the links to the e-alerts in this op-ed piece you're talking about. And so, like yesterday, when the additional 500 feet fell in, within an hour or so, LEAN had an e-alert out. We were also dealing with the people down there, what was occurring, and monitoring the situation. So LEAN is very, very involved. They've sent a photographer in. He's recorded a couple of the meetings I've had with the community, and he's also interviewed quite a few people in the community, and they'll be putting those interviews out on e-alerts as well.
How active, or how should I say this, how is the media, the local mainstream media, presenting this story? Do you think that they're downplaying the story, or do you think that they're just not telling enough because they don't want to panic? Or how do you see how they've responded? And have they attended these meetings is my other question.
So the Baton Rouge Advocate is the state journal newspaper for the state of Louisiana, and it is the newspaper of the greatest circulation in the area of Bayou Corn. And there's a reporter known as a River Parish reporter, and he has had top-of-the-fold stories every single day, and he has done an absolute amazing job of accumulating all the data that's occurred in that time period and putting out an article. So he has provided a huge amount of data and information to the community. And then the Baton Rouge TV stations have been out at the site and documenting as well. The community, however, is very frustrated with both the Department of Natural Resources, which permits these wells and these caverns, because they were not forthcoming about this cavern having had problems, having lost mechanical integrity, having to be plugged and abandoned, information that it was too close to the edge of the salt dome. So that was a really, really hard pill for the community to swallow when these agencies have been down in the community day in and day out, and yet we're not sharing that information. And again, this reporter for The Advocate out of Baton Rouge has done a fabulous job of documenting that as well.
Well, good. It's good when you can get actual journalists that are actually doing journalism work and presenting the stories and the facts without a bias. Really hard to do these days. Kay Kiker asks a question in the chat room. She says, is it true that the U.S. oil and gas reserves are stored in salt domes off the coastline?
The Strategic Petroleum Reserve has storage in salt domes on the coastal areas of Louisiana, not offshore. There is one dome that is part of the Clovelis system, which is a loop, which unloads freighters in the Gulf, puts the oil in the salt dome, and then it's piped onto shore. And I'd like to tell Kay hi. It's been a long time since I've talked to her.
Aww. And Kay, call in if you want to talk. Please, you know, give a ring. The number again for the chat room is 213-816-0357 if you want to talk live to Dr. Wilma Subra. And then somebody else says, Tricia says, oil storage is also in Texas. And she also mentions gas is piped offshore and onshore. So she had made those comments in the chat room. And then she provides a link, which is, for anybody that's hit us up on the actual website for Blog Talk Radio, if you don't see the chat room, just go ahead and refresh your screen if you don't see it, and it should pop right in, and then you'll be able to actually respond to those comments or ask your questions yourself. And then you can click into that link that Tricia has provided there. This is just amazing that the mainstream media has not been talking about this, and I literally have not seen anything in the mainstream media. Maybe somebody else has, but it's just, to me, it's just like downplaying, not providing the info when people really want to know what's going on. How would you say that if they're not using this method for storage, what would be other methods that they could use? Is there any other options that would be safer?
Well, sure. They can store natural gas in above ground storage tanks. However, these caverns are very large, and that's what they're really looking at, to have capacity to store this natural gas in these salt dome caverns. And then when up on the East Coast or up north you have a blizzard, then they make a fortune selling natural gas during the blizzard to the other parts of the country that are suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The other portion is that we have a lot of shale gas development going on in Louisiana and Texas and in Arkansas and Oklahoma, as well as the Marcellus Shale up on the East Coast. But they're looking at taking as much of that natural gas, which is being produced now at a very, very low cost, and storing it as many caverns as they can so they can hold off selling it until the price goes up.
Oh, so it's all about the dollar. The shale, is that the same? When you say the shale, is that the same as fracking?
Yes, you produce that the natural gas in the shale by doing hydraulic fracturing, yes. And I've been all over the country doing presentations on the environmental and human health impacts of the shale gas development.
Wow. Laura Reagan asked a question in the chat room. How large are these domes?
The dome at Napoleonville is 1 mile by 3 miles as far as a surface area, and it extends very, very deep underground. And some of these storage caverns in the dome are like 2,000 to 3,000 to 4,000 feet below the surface.
Wow. This is just, it's hard to believe, but it's almost like that whole, when I think of that whole area of the Gulf region, really just the upper part of the Gulf of Mexico, it's got as much holes as Swiss cheese. It's just like a huge pincushion. So what they haven't been able to drill close to the surface, they just drill and drill and drill and make holes and make these domes and make these caverns with little thought about the human impact. Can you tell us a little bit about the human impact and some of the possibly the symptoms of what people would experience if there is these gas emissions happening full force, not just in Bayou Corn, but everywhere else too?
Okay, so the natural gas itself is not a, quote, hazardous substance or a toxic substance, but it's an explosive hazard. But the issue becomes when you actually drill and produce the natural gas is where you have all the toxic chemicals associated with the drilling process and the fracturing process. And the industry will admit when they do the drilling for shale gas hydraulic fracturing that they contaminate the surface water, surface soil, subsurface groundwater with the chemicals because they have leaks and spills, and that the casing of the well actually has faults in it and leaks into the groundwater. And then the cement they put around to isolate the casing has fractures in it, and it contaminates the groundwater. So in this case, it's the methane is what we've seen bubbling up. But when the sinkhole developed, when the old diesel came to the surface, then the diesel is causing just huge respiratory problems, eyes burning, nausea, vomiting, because it's a really, really high irritant. And it's the analysis show that it's got the volatile organics such as benzene, which is a known human cancer-causing agent. It's got polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons like benzoylpyrene, which are known and suspected to cause cancer. So the material that is floating on the sinkhole in Bayou Corn is causing extensive health impacts. And that was one of the reasons the workers were out there trying to skim it and remove it.
Another question in the chat room. Have there been any radiation tests done on Assumption or in the Assumption area?
Well, that was the other part of information that was not brought to the citizens, is that a number of years ago, as a result of producing this brine water out of this cavern, naturally occurring radioactive material, which in all the states is called NORM and consists of radium-226 and 228. Radium-226 has a half-life of 1,620 years, so it's going to be there for a very long time. They had contamination of this naturally occurring radioactive material in the soil at the wellhead site. So they petitioned to the Department of Natural Resources for permission to put this contaminated soil into the cavern. And the Department of Natural Resources allowed them to, so they have it down in this cavern. And so the Department of Environmental Quality has been monitoring to see if any of that has already come to the surface. And as part of the drilling process, they are required to take samples of any material they come in contact with and analyze it for toxic chemicals and the radiation. So the potential is also there for radiation to get out from this event that is occurring in Bayou Corn.
My question, this is a question that I've had for a long time. I had heard this, but had never gotten any substantial proof that drilling mud itself has radioactive elements. Is that true?
Drilling mud is primarily barium or barite, and it has a very small amount of radioactivity in it. But the formation where the oil and gas is actually subsurface is highly radioactive, and the produced water that comes to the surface with oil and gas contains these radioactive components, and as it comes to the surface, the radiation gets precipitated out and forming scale, and this gets deposited in all the piping and all the vessels, and any of the leaks contaminate the soil.
So would it be safe to say that the people that are actually living in the Gulf region, especially those that are living close to the water, have probably been exposed probably to from minor extent to major to radioactive elements just in their environment?
Well, a number of years ago, Louisiana was the first state that required any type of regulation of this naturally occurring radioactive material. And the first regulation we were able to get passed in the legislature required the oil and gas companies to identify where they had NORM as a result of drilling, production, storage, or whatever. And so we had a huge list, and the estimate was that that was only 10% of the actual locations, but at least they were required to put up monitoring, and they were required to put up signs to let people in the area know that the radioactivity existed in these areas.
And which departments would actually be enforcing that? I mean, they can make these laws and they can say, you need to do this, you need to, you know, keep the citizens warned, but who's enforcing that they do this in effect properly or at all for that matter?
In Louisiana, it's the Department of Environmental Quality that regulates the naturally occurring radioactive material. In some of the other states, it's actually the Department of Health, and it could be the Department of Environmental Quality or the Oil and Gas Agency. So it varies from state to state which agency actually has the authority.
Okay. So I need to find out what's happening here in Florida, and I would say anybody else in the Gulf region, Texas all the way around, you need to check and find out who's actually enforcing that and try to get the numbers of the latest testing as well. Laura Reagan says, yes, we appreciate you, Dr. Subra. Thank you for all your hard work. Let's take it back to April 20th in 2010. Where were you and how did you find out about the Gulf oil gusher, I like to call it. I hate to call it a spill. But where were you and what were your first thoughts about that whole calamity and what was going to happen next?
Well, on April the 20th of 2010, the Deepwater Horizon rig drilling a well for BP exploded. And in the first 24 hours, I immediately started receiving phone calls and emails. In the first 24 hours, there were a number of workers from the Acadiana area where I actually live. And it was from the families that wanted to know what had happened to their loved ones that were working on the rig. There was a supply boat that rescued them, and it had to come inshore to Fouchon, which is the port in lower Louisiana, but there were phones on the boat that could have allowed them to call their loved ones, but they were not allowed to call their loved ones. So that first 24 hours, we were dealing with the families and the anxiety they were going through and determining whether or not their loved ones are alive or dead or whether they were injured. There were actually 11 workers killed instantly as a result of that. And after that first 24 hours, I was then out in the field doing damage assessment, needs assessment, and doing workshops about the kinds of health impacts associated with first the aerosol that was blowing on shore being dispersed in the air from the slick. But then 2 days later was Earth Day, April 22nd, and we had a book we were releasing called Oceans, and it was a complimentary book to go with the Oceans film that Disney was releasing. And as it turned out, that was a non-issue that day because on Earth Day, April 22nd, that's when the rig sank to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. So all evidence went to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And from that point on, I was out doing what the communities needed to do, providing them with technical information, providing them with guidance on what needed to be done, and I've been doing that night and day ever since.
How can you tell us a little bit about the comparison to then in regards to now and the human impact and how, what the people are experiencing in the Gulf region now as a result of that horrible period of time in the Gulf of Mexico? What is the human impact? What are some of the issues and what are some of the health concerns?
Well, there were two populations that were the most impacted early on. There were the communities living on the coastal areas in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and the panhandle of Florida. There was this slick on the Gulf. It took 9 days to come inshore to Louisiana, and that's the first area it hit. But when this slick was on the Gulf, because of the high winds and high seas, it turned into an aerosol, which I sort of compared to a hairspray pump, that kind of material. And it blew inland as much as 100 miles, and it gave people severe headaches and nausea and respiratory problems. And then the other population that was sick was the fishing community who had their fishing grounds closed, and they immediately wanted to go to work for BP to clean up the crude oil that was moving on shore because they felt they knew the environment the best. That was their environment that they earned a living from, and they thought they could protect it the best. But BP was not giving them adequate training and was not providing them with protective gear. So they were also severely, severely impacted, and they desperately needed the job. So they'd come in shore at night, be very sick, but go back out the next morning because they needed this paycheck. But the issue is it was the respiratory, it was skin rashes, it was short-term memory loss, long-term memory loss, a whole host of skin lesions, really, really bad, and it has continued today. We're now some 2.5 years since then, and there's still a very, very large sick population that's still being impacted because on a daily basis, crude oil that is subsurface in the Gulf continues to wash onshore in the form of tar balls and mats and strings. There's still huge quantities of oil left in the coastal areas and the wetlands and along the beaches in the sand subsurface. So it's still an event that is occurring on an ongoing basis, and these people are very sick, and we're very limited in the medical physicians who are willing to treat them. We have one medical doctor, Dr. Michael Robichaux in Raceland, who has treated a large number of them from all the coastal areas. But yet the other doctors are reluctant to say, oh, you just have a respiratory problem, I'll give you antibodies, go away. They're reluctant to look at all the health impacts associated with the chemicals in both the crude oil and the dispersant that we use to disperse the crude oil. And it's just unbelievable how many people are very sick, lost their jobs, lost their houses, lost their boats, lost their cars, still very sick, are not able to work, and are being put in harm's way on a daily basis.
And do you think that the proper way to have done this back probably in the early months after the whole incident would have been to mass evacuate people then? Would that have been the proper way to operate and to get people out of harm's way?
Well, a lot of people did voluntary evacuations when they realized that that aerosol was blowing on shore and making them sick. The fishing community, there was no way they could evacuate because their home is along the bayous and the wetland areas and the bays, and that's where they needed to be. And there was a lot of talk about whether we should have done a mandatory evacuation. But we've had those situations after Hurricane Katrina and Rita, after Gustav and Ike, and we've just been through one disaster after the other. And when you relocate these large number of people, you run out of places where they can go and be comfortable or where they can continue to earn a living to survive.
Yeah, especially the seafood, the people in the seafood industry. Somebody just tried to call and dropped off. So I encourage you to try to call back again if the call did not go through. Please try and call us back again, and I'll click you through. Laura Reagan is in the chat room, and she left a message here. She said, Dr. Subra held a forum in New Orleans in February of 2010, I don't think. Maybe Maybe that was a typo. She said, my husband read the article in the Times-Picayune the next day, and then he connected the dots when he read the symptoms that Dr. Suber listed in her forum. This information saved my husband's life. So she wanted you to know that. She wrote that in the little chat.
Thank you, Laura.
I would say that people that listened and had the funds probably could get out of Dodge pretty quick. But a lot of people, especially the people up north, could not understand what was going on down here in the South, where we do have much more poverty or people living paycheck to paycheck. I know in my state there are hardly any unions, and it's a right-to-work state, and we've had lower wages than up north for many, many years, and we also have seasons which are really economically distressing. Okay, I'm clicking in this person at area code 985. Hi, 985 area code. Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from?
Yes, my name is Juliet, and I'm calling from Thibodaux, Louisiana. I just wanted to make a comment about the BP, the effects that it had on people. Y'all were talking about the respiratory problems and the skin problems. Well,
right.
My brother worked on the cleanup for BP from the time it started to the time it finished, and he developed, we're not sure if it's bladder cancer or prostate cancer, because at first they said it came from the bladder. It was a tumor in the bladder. And then they removed his bladder and his prostate and some of the lymph nodes in the area. And now they're saying that it originated from the prostate instead of the bladder. Now, he said when he was on the boat, he was the captain of a boat, that when he was on the boat, he said the BP officials were coming on the boat and asking the men if they were having problems urinating or if they had blood in their urine or anything like that. And that's when they were on the job. And now, a year or whatever it is, a year or so later, he came down with this problem. And I think he's kind of having trouble with them taking responsibility, because they said that whatever chemicals they were using, could cause bladder cancer, and that was the original diagnosis, and now the doctors are saying it came from the prostate. So I just wanted to make that comment that I don't know if people were aware of that or not, that it affects so many different things, you know.
And that's a question that I have, Dr. Subra, is, how do you draw the line on what conditions are actually caused by the crude and what conditions
right.
can actually be caused by all the other carcinogens and toxic elements that come with the dispersants or the drilling mud or whatever else is being used out there?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just all a toxic mess?
Yeah.
So early in the process, I put together a list of the health impacts associated with the components in the crude, and a second list with the health impacts associated with the components in the dispersant that was used. And within 6 months, we were seeing the acute, the short-term, as well as the chronic impacts manifesting themselves.
Mm-hmm. So where would you place something like prostate cancer or bladder cancer?
Well, the issue is a lot of the workers were having blood in their urine and bleeding from the ears, and so it is associated with what then develops long-term after the exposure.
Right, right. And he is being treated by Dr. Michael Robichaux in Raceland also. And he's just, yes, in fact, he got out of the hospital today. He had his bladder removed in May, and his prostate, and he's been back into surgery twice since then, having problems with the tubes kinking, and he had to go in Thursday, and the two-hour surgery that was supposed to take 2 to 4 hours ended up taking 9.5 hours. He's having scar tissue issues now that's kinking the tubes coming from the kidneys. So it's, you know, we're hoping and praying that once all the little issues are, you know, fixed and everything, that he can go on and live as normal a life as he can, you know. So, okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your call and your input, and I'm glad he's getting better, too. So that's
yes.
That's a positive. So it's not all negative, and it's not all the end of the road when you come, you know, when you come towards a sickness like this. It can actually be, through the miracle of science and medicine, some of these things can be reversed, and people
right.
can live quality lives. So that's a good thing, you know.
Yeah,
so,
the main thing is that he, you know, he can continue living. You know, can I make a little input also on this sinkhole in Bayou Corn? I work in that area, and I quit passing through there. I started passing a different way to go to work because the diesel smell is so strong in the air, it takes your breath away. And the sinkhole is growing more and more, and you just don't know if you're going to pass down there. The road that I pass on is like a half a mile from the sinkhole. And, I mean, you don't know if you're going to be on that road and you're going to get sucked up, you know, sucked in. Or if it's going to explode and you're going to get blown up, because it's like right now, it's just the fear of the unknown. We don't know what's going to happen, you know, and it's just it's a terrible, terrible thing. So I've been touched. That's been a part of my life too since you know, this is all happening, and it's very, very sad because I know people that live there and that'll probably lose their homes, and I just hope that, you know, the people don't get sick from all of this, you know, with everything that's the diesel smell in the air is just it's unreal. So, okay, well.
So it really is the unknown, and that is frightening.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And do you know anybody that lives near there?
Oh, yes. The man I work for, his daughter lives about three quarters of a mile from the sinkhole. And his granddaughter lives a half a mile from the sinkhole, about a half a mile. And she lives right across the street from, you know, from where it is. And they had to evacuate. And they've been seeing these bubbles in the water, you know, I think since March. And the, you know, it was just like, oh, that's just swamp gas. Those people are crazy. You know, it ain't nothing. And, you know, and now all of this stuff is happening, and it's really starting to snowball, it looks like, you know, and now they brought in this big old drilling rig to drill, to do some exploration, and I'm afraid of that. That's the reason why I quit passing in front of there, all the vibrations and everything. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, and I know a lot, you know, everybody feels that way, but it's a sad thing, and it's a hard thing on the people. And they need a lot of prayer.
We should all say prayers for everybody that's living close by and
definitely.
Is affected, because people are going to lose their homes. And that's,
mm-hmm.
you know, when, like Dr. Suber has said, these are people that, you know, they've had those homes for generations. That property's been passed down through families.
Right,
and
that's true.
Lost all their rights. They're going to lose all their rights to that property. But I almost think that this is kind of like a dance with the devil. What do you think, Dr. Suber? It's kind of like Louisiana kind of gave the oil and gas companies a foothold, and then they came in and they just sucked everything up. What do you think about that whole situation and just the politics of this? Now that they're there, it's like you can't get them to leave. They've completely taken over. They own everything, and they own everybody. So where do you go from that, you know?
Well, the politics is that they're in very much control because they have the money and they have the power. I think what Bayou Corn is showing that the people can demand to know what's really going on and see what went wrong in their community that they weren't aware of, and try and get things done better next time, so the community is always aware and always participating in the decision-making
process, which didn't occur prior to this, but those people are going to be watching out from now on, not only for their community, but they're going to be watching out for a lot of the other communities in Louisiana.
And do you think that the people of Louisiana, and I'm speaking kind of in general terms here, do you think because of what's happened over the past several years, they've become very much more politically aware and more active? Are they up off their butts and going to these community meetings and demanding a say-so?
Well, when it happens in your community, then suddenly the community becomes involved. And in the long term, once they become involved in their community, they start helping other communities, and it grows. And that's what Louisiana Environmental Action Network is all about. It's an umbrella group of all the grassroots groups in Louisiana, and they bring the grassroots groups together and enable them to help not only themselves but other groups as well.
Now, do you also work with the Louisiana Bucket Brigade as well?
I do on some occasions, yes, in specific areas, yes.
And we don't have a group like that here in Florida, and I wish we did. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that group does and why it's so important?
The Bucket Brigade group?
Yes.
Okay. They actually train people to collect air samples in what they've manufactured is a bucket with a Tyvek bag to collect the air samples. I prefer to use the Sumer canister, which is a stainless steel canister with a valve on the top that you get from a lab that's certified and evacuated, and then you just open the valve and it draws the air in. And then once you do that, the analysis is all the same. There are a number of labs that do the analysis of the air samples and determine what's in your air. And DEQ is actually doing that type of air sampling in the Sumer canisters in the Bayou Corn area, and I've been reviewing that data and preparing it in a form that the citizens can understand.
So I'm wondering why we don't have something like that here in Florida, because that is something that's definitely needed here, because I know we've got a lot of that toxic air here just from the winds. I mean, we get the sea breezes that come directly east from the middle of the Gulf. There's a comment in the chat room from Tricia, I believe. She says, BP and the EPA knew Corexit was toxic. And then I can add to that and say, and yeah, they knew it was toxic, and they still used it. And even, what was his name, the congressman from Massachusetts, he said, the Gulf of Mexico was carpet bombed with Corexit. I wish I could remember his name. It's at the tip of my tongue. But why the continued use of this carcinogen when everyone knows that it's toxic? Why do they continue with it?
Well, BP had two goals after the Deepwater Horizon explosion fire and it sank. Was one, to stop the flow of crude oil as quickly as possible, and we know that didn't work. And two, to stop as much of the crude oil from getting to the coastal areas of Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama. And we know that didn't work as well. But they wanted to sink it in the Gulf so it wouldn't come on shore in the coastal areas.
And for every
93 gallons of crude oil that was released into the environment from the wellhead, a gallon of dispersant was applied. So we not only had the crude oil spill, we had a huge quantity of dispersant released into the environment.
Right. And of course, you know, they wanted to sink it so they wouldn't be fined for, you know, because each barrel, of course, that's released, they're fined for that. So by sinking it, they could, in effect, temporarily destroy the evidence. And Kay said it was Congressman Edward Markey from Massachusetts, and I said in the chat room she said that, and I said, yep, that's right, that was him, and that's even on video, that's on a YouTube video where he states the Gulf of Mexico was carpet bombed with Corexit. There was another question here from Kay. Is the geology around the sinkhole seismic?
Well, it's seismic because the event that occurred before the sinkhole developed was causing earthquakes, and it was causing earthquakes in the immediate area of this one particular cavern in the dome.
Okay.
Other than that, it's not a great seismic area.
Right. And as you said before, if you check USGS, you might see some seismic activity, but it can be construed with the activity that's going on above the surface. So,
exactly.
And yeah, Kay
exactly.
said, Congressman Markey said that on C-SPAN. Yeah, what was on C-SPAN was actually put on YouTube. So that's where I saw it, Congressman Markey making that statement. So where do we go from here? What are some of the things that citizens can be doing now, and what do we need now? My idea is that we need toxic clinics or detox clinics throughout the area. What else is needed in the Gulf region?
Well, as a result of the BP spill, we need more physicians trained to deal with the toxicity of what was in the crude and what was in the dispersants so that they can treat these patients. So we need physicians trained and willing to treat these patients, and a number of detox clinics or whatever type of treatment these trained physicians would bring to the area. When you talked about Florida, I've worked with a number of communities in Florida. If you would like help, I will work with Louisiana Environmental Action Network, and we'll get you some help in Florida that of the kind that you think would be appropriate. And then for the people of Bayou Corn, it's just keeping track of what the data is saying on a day-to-day basis and the situation as it's moving forward, keeping the community educated and informed, and having people do whatever type of support they can for that community because they desperately, desperately need support.
What would some of the warning signs be for people to get out, get the hell out of the way in Bayou Corn? If they were to see something or hear something, what would trigger them to have to leave?
Noise, tremors in the earth, and you're going to feel a lot of that with the drilling, so it can mask any of that. They've reported a lot of subsidence and sinkholes, smaller, but throughout the community, so we're now actually plotting those, and they've also reported a lot of areas with bubbling, so we're plotting all of those to bring to the agency and say these are where it's occurring, not only in the big sinkhole and on the bayous, but in these other areas. So we're putting together that kind of information and sharing it with the agencies, and there is actually a command center there, and so when something's going to start building up to a crescendo, the agencies are going to know, and the agency's going to immediately notify those that chose not to get out.
To those of you that are listening, I had mentioned the article that my friend wrote on Op-Ed News, Marilyn Butler's article. It's headlined, "Does Sudden Sinkhole Portend a Nuclear-Sized Explosion?" Dr. Suber was one of the people interviewed for that article. If you go there to opednews.com and you check that out, "Does Sudden Sinkhole Portend a Nuclear-Sized Explosion?" and scroll down on the first page of the article, there is a map with a legend right below it. The items that are listed on the legend for this map are the actual site of the sinkhole, the salt dome contour by the blue line. The red line is the salt dome contour at 1,000-foot depth. Yellow, okay, I understand this now. The blue line is the salt dome contour at 10,000 feet depth, and then the red line is the salt dome contour at 1,000 feet depth. So it's almost like it gets smaller as you get closer to the surface. Is that correct?
Yes, it's like a salt finger that pushed up in ancient times, and it's smaller at the surface, and it gets bigger as you go deeper depths.
Deeper down. And then the yellow circles are the clotted bubble sites that are coming up out of the water. The orange circle, orange circles are the OxyGeismar Well 3. What would that be? The OxyGeismar.
That's the well that had the casing down into the cavern that lost integrity, and that's the cavern they're drilling the relief well into.
Okay. The red circles are the gas storage wells. The light blue circles are the plugged abandoned wells. And
right.
Then you have the dark circles, which are the brine wells. So anybody that wants to see that map and the legend that's right below it, you'll kind of get a greater understanding of how this is all plotted out on the map. So go to opednews.com, then click on the article link, and it'll take you, it's a two-page article, but the map and legend are on the first page of that article. And it shows some other pictures too. So there was a picture here taken on August 6th that Maryland used for the article, and at that point, it was pretty big. It was sucking trees in, and you can see that from the actual aerial photo. How much has it grown since August 6th, would you say?
At that time, it was about 4 to 5 acres, and since then, we've lost 500 feet on one side and 200 feet on another side.
So this is going to be ongoing until they figure out what the heck to do. This is really. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the toxic clinics, but also, I think I wanted to formulate this on higher education too. We know what we need to do in regards to getting the doctors and getting them trained on toxicity and how to help people. I'm finding that a lot of the colleges and the research departments in the institutes of higher learning have taken money from BP. The University of South Florida, which is here in Tampa, got $500 million from BP to fund their studies. What do you think of this type of activity? Is it a conflict of interest? Is it a way for the scientists to keep their studies funded? Is it a way to keep the numbers manipulated or downplayed? What's your take on all that?
It's a way for BP to engage these professors in working for BP so they can't work for the other side in any lawsuits. It's also a mechanism that when they receive this kind of money, it's for long-term studies, so that data is very, very slow in getting to be in the public arena. So they work for a number of years, and then they write articles, and it gets peer-reviewed. And so on an instant level, that information is not available to the community. The work that I do and the work that Louisiana Environmental Action Network does, and we've done sampling of the water, the sediment, and the tissue, and as soon as we get data back, within hours, we have it out to the communities and out to the public. So it's just a mechanism of tying up those universities so that they are indebted to BP and not able to do work that communities need on an ongoing and instantaneous basis.
As I started to do the research on this, and I found, I mean, I was mentioning this to people in media here, and I was sending information out about this $500 million that USF had actually been granted. And, of course, the money's not all coming in one big sum. It's coming in dribs and drabs and a little bit here and a little bit there. But it was definitely contracted out. And people were calling me a conspiracy theorist, and I'm going, look, it was in the school newspaper. USF's
right.
School newspaper is called The Oracle. And I said, and it was written right in an article in The Oracle. So I'm taking this from information that's actually coming from the university. So how can this be a conspiracy theory? It was almost like people were brainwashed. Their minds had shut off completely to the possibility of these universities being purchased, you know, to the whole science departments of the universities had been purchased, as you had said. So I was quite shocked over that, actually. And I told everybody I could about it and wrote about it and blogged about it. And, you know, I'm still getting people asking about that. And then, of course, going to some of these events, the human impact was never, ever discussed. They talked about everything else, the makeup of a wave, relocation of turtle eggs, all kinds of stuff that is important environmentally, but it had nothing to do with the human impact, and the human impact was not mentioned, and it was not allowed to be talked about. So do you have any comments about any of that?
Well, I'm out there evaluating the human impacts, doing health surveys, doing economic surveys, and presenting that information to the communities and to the medical community about what's really going on as a result of this. And that is what I do on a day-to-day basis, and try and get the kind of medical help that is so desperately needed for these impacted communities.
How many people do you think that you have actually, if you can estimate or guesstimate, how many people have you actually dealt with in regards to toxic human impact, illness, since April of 2010?
Well, the work I've done and the work I've done with Louisiana Environmental Action Network, 100,000 individuals, and heard the impacts on probably another 200,000.
So we're talking about 300,000 people, a quarter of a million people in the Gulf region, over a quarter million people. That is amazing. So people still continue to look at me with blank stares when I mention the Gulf oil spill and the human impact. And they're looking at me like the media has completely, I can't think of another word to even compare with it. It's brainwashed that everything is back to normal, that they're recreating on the water. Tell us a little bit about the seafood, because that's been a big issue. I've been telling my own personal friends and family, please don't eat the seafood. Tell us a little bit about the testing on that.
Well, first of all, BP is spending a lot of money on PR to bring the message that everything on the Gulf Coast is back to normal and fine, and people should come down to the beaches and to the marshes and the swamps. We've been evaluating seafood since the summer of 2010, and in some species we see the polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons bioaccumulating, and in others we see a steady state. These concentrations are below what levels of concern are, but the issue is the cumulative impact. So we continue to do sampling, and we continue to put out the data so that the people who are deciding whether or not to harvest the seafood and sell it and consume it, as well as people who are just consuming it, will have that information and can make personal decisions.
Great. Okay, we have a caller. Let me click them in. Caller 601 area code, can you tell us your name and where you're calling from? Hello? 601 area code? Hello? You're on the air. Sorry, we can't hear you. Can you try calling back? Hello? Okay, well, I for some reason they're not able to hear us. I hope they drop off and call us back. So you all have received the same commercials that we have down here in Florida. I don't know how much your state spends on tourism, but here in Florida, tourism is our main business here, mm-hmm. and it's our main industry. And I've gotten two numbers. I don't know which one's correct. I've heard $65 billion a year or $85 billion a year. My guess is that it's somewhere in the middle. And the only other thing that even comes close at maybe $25 billion is real estate, but I'm sure that's gone down since because of the foreclosures. So, you know, what BP has done is really just tried to convince people that the said everything's fine, the water's fine, the seafood's fine, come down, stay in a hotel, go to Disney World, eat the shrimp. And can you tell us about the condition of the seafood, as the most recent pictures and reports have been somewhat frightening?
Well, working with the fishing community all along the coastal areas of the northern Gulf of Mexico, we've gotten huge, huge reports of the crabs with holes in them, the shrimp with no eyes, and the fish with lesions on them. So we've been documenting this type of thing. Eels, a lot of the Vietnamese community eat the eels, and they have a lot of skin lesions on the eels. So we're documenting those types of things and providing that information to the communities as well as the regulatory agencies. The oysters were heavily impacted both by the oil and by the fresh water that was put in to try and push the oil offshore shore. And so the oysters are even non-existent or very small, and then the catches that we're hearing reported even this year are really reduced. So tracking it over the long term is going to be able to really see how bad an impact. If you looked at the Alaska oil spill, it was many years before some of the species actually collapsed. So we're trying to do as much monitoring similar to that as possible.
So do you think anything is close to collapse right now?
Not that I'm aware of. I know the oyster population's having a real difficult time coming back, but I think we're seeing reductions but not collapse yet.
Okay, 601 is trying to call us again. Just a moment. I'm going to click them in. Okay, 601, I have you on the air. Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from? They dropped again. They must be having some phone problems. But anyway, please try and call again, 601, if you're listening in. Well, I think one of my biggest fears down here in Florida is the latest reports we have on oysters here causing Vibrio. And just there was a newspaper article that came out this week, actually from the Tampa Bay Times, I believe, that there was two people that died in Hillsborough County from eating oysters. So I'm not sure what's happening or where those oysters came from. But, you know, I've heard some serious stories about the oyster beds in Apalachicola. And most of, you know, after talking to people and talking to people that are actually restaurateurs, that is where they get most of their oysters, is the Apalachicola area. And there was also sickness there, I think it was last year, in regards to cholera and a few other conditions that could have been caused from eating contaminated seafood. Did you know anything about the cholera outbreak?
I don't. I didn't keep up with that.
But also, Tricia makes a comment in the chat room, Florida is the most corrupt state in the Gulf Coast to benefit the economy via tourism. And it sure was corrupt in regards to the foreclosures and homes. And also, I was also asked, Anita, why are those oysters not being tested? I don't know why those oysters are not being tested and why they're even being served at this point. It's really just scary. The restaurateurs are still serving sushi. They're serving the raw oysters at oyster bars. And frankly, I won't touch any of that anymore. So I'm trying to get a handle on we talked a little bit about clinics for toxicity. Who do you think would be responsible, or would this come out of BP money, or would BP ever agree to providing these clinics for the sick and affected people.
Well, one of the interesting things is part of the negotiated settlement with BP that's in front of the courts, but getting very close to being finally approved, has BP putting forth a huge chunk of money for primary care all along the northern Gulf of Mexico. And this primary care is desperately needed. After Hurricane Katrina, we desperately needed primary care for all of the citizens. But BP is specific in that none of this care can be specific to the kinds of toxicity health impacts associated with exposure to the crude and the dispersant. So once again, it's putting on a fancy face of look how much money we've put up for health care. And people who don't look under those layers think, well, they're responding to all the health care issues. They're not. They're only putting up money for primary health care and not for the health care that we so desperately need by all of these people that have been impacted.
Now, some months ago, somebody had told me, and this was probably more than 6 months ago, that not a single medical claim had ever been paid out by BP. Is that still true, or has that changed?
Since they changed the person supervising it, I think some medical claims may have been, but just a few. And the issue was the first time they paid a medical claim that was admitting that they had caused a medical issue.
So that's the big drawback, the money thing, that and actually admitting liability. So that is why they're in denial in regards to the medical situation in the Gulf region, which is, as you said, probably 300,000 people, over a quarter million people. And those are only the people that you know about. And those are the
right
people that those are the people that that really can relate their illness or their condition to the toxic levels in the region. And probably there's many, many other people that haven't made that connection, that have toxic levels but never made the connection to BP or thought for some reason that they were not or could not be affected. You know, maybe they're living inland. They didn't think they breathed and they didn't come into contact with the water, et cetera. I wanted to ask you some other questions, and this is where we get into kind of the tinfoil hat stuff. And maybe you can kind of clarify this, or you may know about it, you may not. My question is, what happens now in the Gulf region when somebody wants to grow organic vegetables? Are we past the tipping point of being able to do that? Is our environment so toxic that nothing can ever be organic again? Fill me in on your thoughts on that.
Each state has agencies that regulate the organic growers and the criteria they have to meet. And if you are very careful, you can legitimately grow organic produce and sell it in areas that are not being impacted.
So we're not all as lost in regards to that. We have 601 on with us again, 601 area code. Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from?
Yes, I'm calling from Hattiesburg, but I am not pressing 1.
You're not what? I'm sorry?
I'm not pressing 1 to speak. I'm just here to listen.
Oh, okay. Well, I just saw you on here, and I thought you were calling in. Do you want me to drop the call?
No, I want to listen to the show. I just don't want to speak. I'm just listening to what's going on.
Okay, you're more than welcome to listen in this way. That's fine then.
Okay.
Now, Laura Reagan made a comment in the chat room. She said, I meet people every day that have been exposed and are sick and haven't connected the dots. And I can honestly say, Laura, that I've done that too, where people are telling me they ate seafood, they got sick, or they have this breathing problem or that breathing problem. Tell us, Dr. Super, how this affects children differently, how the toxic levels affect children in a worse, more malefic way than adults, and why?
Well, there's vulnerable populations. There's the elderly, there's the children, and then there's the people with cancer and on chemo. And they are more severely impacted than the normal healthy adult that's exposed. And so we've had a lot of children have these health impacts that desperately need medical treatment. But again, we're lacking in the medical treatment.
Mm-hmm. And the children are taking in the higher level or much higher level per body mass with the toxic carcinogens. So they're like, they're taking more in. They're taking in, like, say, double or more than what their parents are taking in. So what are some of the conditions that parents can be alerted to in their children?
Well, there's the respiratory issues. There's the cardiovascular issues. There's the skin lesion issues and just chronic respiratory problems that occur because they come in contact or in close contact with the crude that's still there in the environment.
What about asthma and COPD and conditions like that? Are those exacerbated?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Okay. And what happens with people that have like a lower immune system, such as AIDS patients or anybody else with a lupus or autoimmune deficiency?
They get more severe health impacts and they last for a longer time and they have a much more difficult time recovering from them.
So anybody that has these issues, you would say it's probably best to relocate.
Well, they have to consider where they are and how much exposure is going on and look at it from the personal perspective.
Right. And then that leads me to this other question. Is there any place that's really safe? Because we're looking at the Gulf region because we live here. All of us live here. There's people in the chat room I know that live here in this region. And then what I start to hear about what's happened in places I've lived before, like in Pennsylvania and in Michigan. Michigan has its own issues in the Kalamazoo area with a mass oil spill. And then I'm looking at Pennsylvania with the fracking situation, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and that whole area. Is there any place safe where this is not going on? And I can't come up with a single place that doesn't have something going on that's disturbing the environment and putting us in harm's way. What would you say to people that just want to find a safe place to live and raise their children?
I think you've gotten a good grasp of the things that occur in various locations in the United States. And before you go and decide to move somewhere, you need to look at what's going on in that area. I've had a lot of families decide to relocate, and then when they started looking around, they saw all the other bad aspects of the areas they were considering moving into. So you just have to go in with a very open mind and do the investigation before you make a decision of where you will relocate if that's what you decide to do.
It's almost like I just want to get on a mountaintop. If they're not blowing the mountain up for coal, I want to get on a mountaintop and just never come off of the mountaintop, just stay there. But it's been pretty frightening lately to hear about the mountaintop removal in West Virginia and the fracking in Pennsylvania. And this is all energy-driven, and these companies and corporate are making billions and billions and have, in all effect, become their own countries, and they own us. And
this has
happened, and this is why the people have to stand up and rise up and say no more. What do people need to be doing politically?
Getting involved in the situation, understanding what is going on politically in your state and in your county, and participating in the process, because citizens, when they get involved, realize that frequently the people they elected to what they envisioned was to protect them aren't really protecting them. So they need to really start looking at the different candidates and the actions of the candidates and how the government agencies operate.
I think, and I can tell people this because I'm an elected official myself and have worked on three presidential campaigns, the easiest way that you can find out about candidates is to follow the money. I ran for office and I didn't spend $300, so I know it can be done, and I got over 82,000 votes, so I know it can be done. Tricia writes, somewhat off subject, any idea why so many trucks carrying silicone tetrafluoride are seen around the Mobile, Alabama area? Any thoughts on that, Dr. Subra?
It's manufactured in the area, and it services a lot of the petrochemical industry in the area.
Okay.
And it helps if you start paying attention what's on the trucks. It's amazing if you stop at a rail crossing for a train and start reading what's on the train cars. So all of a sudden you start realizing what's being transported through your area, and you can go to your emergency response agency and see where it's coming from and where it's going to.
And then you just connect the dots at that point and find out, you know, what it's being used for.
Exactly.
Kay Kiker, she says, why did the EPA allow Corexit to be sprayed on the coastline near homes without notifying the public?
It was an issue that BP was making most of the decisions. The federal agencies were involved in those decisions. But in my opinion, it was because the federal agencies were reluctant to make a decision counter to what BP wanted, because then the federal agency would be liable for any environmental and human health damage as a result of their decisions.
Laura Reagan asked, She said, my great-granddaughter went by the seashore in Pensacola two times and was rushed to Children's Hospital two times with chest pain and shortness of breath and diagnosed with, I've never even heard of this, diagnosed with costochondritis. Do you have any ideas on that? And she had hexane over 300.
Right. And I am aware of that situation. And, again, it's a continuing exposure. It's when you go to the seashore, you come in contact with the crude oil that's still there, and you start having these health impacts. So then the
decision
becomes...
And I just wanted to say hi to Peter Frizzell, and he's got a question here. Have all the states affected by the BP disaster raised the acceptable limits of contamination in regards to seafood? Good question.
The answer is no. The Food and Drug Administration established the state level specifically for the BP spill. These levels were not to be used for any other event, and they only took into effect the normal consumption of seafood rate, which didn't match the consumption of seafood rate on the coastal areas of the Gulf Coast.
Okay, wow, those were really, really great thought-provoking questions. And again, if you've got any more questions, you can write them in the chat or give us a call at 213-816-0357. Can you tell us, Dr. Subra, what are you going to be working on over the next couple of months? And also, this is kind of a twofer question, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, first of all, I just have about 5 minutes left because I have an appointment. But the issue is, what am I going to be working on in the next couple of months? Shale gas. I have a number of appointments to do presentations in various states. I will be working on the Bayou corn issue. I will be continuing to work on the BP situation and whatever other disasters occur. And we are hoping we don't have a hurricane disaster this year.
Oh, God, everybody's praying about that. We just want to keep those storms away because
exactly.
That would be calamitous, I'm sure. How do you see yourself in 5 years when you're retired? Hopefully not in a rocking chair, right?
No, not in a rocking chair. Continuing to do what I do to help the citizens understand the issues and help them make decisions for their own community.
And I want to thank you for being on the show tonight. This was amazing. If we have any other questions, I can email them to you, and I'll post them on the blog, and I will also send you a link to the show so you can viral it through your own networks. But, you know, this was an amazing eye-opening show. We need to right now watch the Bayou Corn area, and perhaps you can come on the show again and give us an update in a couple of months.
I'll be glad to do that.
Yeah, but thank you so much. And for anybody else, I'm going to stay on the line if you have any other questions or you want to call in. But Dr. Subra, we will talk to you again, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you
for what you do.
You're welcome.
Did anybody have any other questions? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and release the call. Okay. Dr. Subra is gone. Did anybody have any other questions? If you want to call and talk, you can do that too. It's 213-816-0357. If not, I'll go ahead and close the show now. I know Kay is typing, so I'm going to anxiously await what she has to say. I hope you all have taken a look at Merrill's article. Again, I'm going to tell you how to find it. Go to Op-Ed News. Her article is on the headline. It's called, Does Sudden Sinkhole Portend a Nuclear-Sized Explosion? You can read that article. It's a two-pager. It has some great aerial photos. It has some videos. It has the map of the area and the legend to go with it. And when you go on to the second page, it describes everything in a little bit more detail, and it also talks about the recovery well drilling, which is going to take over 40 days to dig down in there, according to Dr. Subra. And Kay has said thank you, and with that, if there's nobody else, okay, now I see Laura typing. And if you all have any other questions, please, if you don't want to come on the show, you can email them to me at anitastewart@gmail.com. Also, don't forget that we have a WePay link up at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com. Feel free to donate to keep our show on the air. And we also want to say thank you to our sponsors, Roundtree 7, Here Be Monsters, Daughters of Isis, Hoodooed, Power New Media and Public Relations, Tarot and Stars, and Florida Nature Photos. And everybody says thanks, and I want to say thank you to everybody for listening in. And be sure to viral this show. So within a few minutes after I close the show, the archive link will be available, and I'm going to send it out to all of you, and I'll be sure to post it in some of the groups on Facebook too. So good night, everybody. Oh, one more comment. We need to attend city council and get involved in local government, run for office. It is the only way to recover our government away from mega corporations. Also, I want to add to that and say, if you don't have a movetoamend.org group in your town, go to the site, movetoamend.org, and form one yourself. Corporations are not people, and money is not free speech. So you need to get on the bandwagon with movetoamend.org, get a local resolution adopted in your town, and then do it for your county, and then do it for your state, and then we can hit up national, and we can get this Citizens United overturned. So corporations will no longer be people, and money will not equate to free speech. Okay, I want to thank you all, and have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week on Wise Women Media, the radio show, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here, same place. Talk to you soon, and good night. Thank you.